please enjoy this previously recorded segment.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And welcome to the HR Power Hour. Today, we want to welcome Deborah Weiss Ford, employment attorney with Jackson Lewis Law Firm. Today, we have a great topic, workplace romance, love, sex, and the employer. That's right. It's catchy, Deb. You always have the catchiest titles.
I try, Dave. Helps you promote it.
Yeah, it's a good thing. Well, welcome back to the show. I appreciate you being on.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Well, you know, this is a topic, all kidding aside in the topic itself, that employers do deal with. You know, office romance does happen. Workplace romance does happen. What are some of the most common things that you see that employers face first in this area?
So you're right. It is a common workplace issue. Actually, one out of four employees reported they have been or are currently involved in a workplace romance. And 43% of HR professionals reported current instances of workplace romance at their organization. So it is a high percentage of people who tend to get involved at work. Not really surprising, considering how much time we spend at work. But the effects of it can be quite difficult for the employer.
No, I think you're right. A lot of people say, hey, look, I'm at work almost more than I am at home, and thus I see my, quote, work family almost more than I see my home family.
That's correct. That's correct. So, you know, I think we can all understand how workplace flings or long-term relationships, even marriages, or just short-term relationships develop fairly easily at the workplace.
Sure. Well, you know, look, we do harassment training. We all do that. We do sexual harassment training. And we always talk about in training that it's unwanted connections, right? Unwanted things that happen. But when two people are in a workplace romance, to start with, typically it's usually not a problem until maybe something goes wrong, right?
That's correct. And, you know, as you know, it's important to have sexual harassment policy. It's important to have teeth to that policy, and important that not only employees but managers and supervisors are trained on it as well. And workplace dating, workplace romances really falls into that guise of sexual harassment training and should be done by employers.
So let's start from the beginning. An employer is looking to know about this, right? So they should start with their employer handbook. What type of things should they be looking at? What type of things can they really do? Especially if an employer is thinking to themselves, gosh, it might happen in my workplace. Do I, as you said, one out of four, it probably will happen in my workplace. How do I want to handle this?
So there are several different tips that we can give to employers. First of all, I think an outright ban on relationships in the office isn't usually the best practice or option for companies. Most surveys show that when there is an outright ban, workers tend to hide it, and that just creates a bad environment all the way around. But what employers can do is to develop consensual relationship policies, which essentially discourage but do not forbid relationships between managers or supervisors and subordinate employees. So I think it starts first with a policy that discourages relationships in the workplace, but then does ban certain types of relationships, such as the relationship between the supervisor and the subordinate.
So this question always comes up when we're dealing with this. So a supervisor and a subordinate get into a consensual relationship. They bring it forward. And then the employer says, well, you know, one of you has to go, whether leave or go to another location or something happens. And then they both go, well, who? And that always becomes a problem. So talk about that a few minutes.
Yeah, that is a tremendous problem, I think, for the employer, because there are certain options that the employer can take when they find out that people are involved in a consensual relationship. And that can vary from transferring one or both parties to the relationship, terminating one or both parties to the relationship, or somehow adjusting the lines of reporting or communication. So in the issue of transferring or terminating, of course, it becomes a difficult problem. Who is the person who gets transferred, and how do you determine that person, and what are the criteria? And as always in employment law, I think it's important to be consistent. So in other words, we certainly don't want to say that it's always going to be the male or always the female that's going to get transferred for the obvious discrimination issues. So somehow employers, I think, have to develop criteria to have a consistent, effective policy of the transfer or the termination, and making sure that the impact of that policy is not always adversely affecting one sex over the other.
So, you know, okay, so that can happen, obviously, that, you know, they make that determination. Is it best practice to let the employees work it out?
That I see that. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I bet half the time I see employers basically tell the employees, you need to make the decision. And that can be effective, although it obviously creates a lot of anxiety on the employees, and it can have a negative effect on the workforce as well. Those type of decisions tend to take more time, and the more time this is up in the air, the less desirable it is for the workplace. So my own preference is to have the employer make the decision, and that ought to be based on various criteria, length of service, performance issues, critical need issues. That type of analysis, I think, needs to take place on an individualized basis to decide who's going to stay and who's going to go.
So you're making these decisions, you're trying to be as effective and care for what the employee believes in, right, in terms of their emotional state and what's happening. Do employers sometimes just have to bite the bullet and say, okay, nope, this is the way it's going to be, and we don't take into any consideration, is there a form they should have? Is there a document they should have when they're making these calls? Should they document why the decision was made? What type of documentation goes along with this?
I'm always in favor of employers documenting adverse decisions that employers make in the workforce. I think that's always good, consistent practice to have. In case litigation results from whatever decision an employer makes, of course you want to have good, solid documentation, detailed documentation, so that you can provide an analysis and support for the decisions that you make. I think in this particular field, having a checklist for who you're going to keep and who you're not going to keep is difficult. That is, it's hard to think of a checklist that is going to cover these situations, because they're so fact-intensive and based on the specific circumstances of each relationship. But having said that, the documentation of the analysis that is done, I think, becomes a critical component in defending litigation.
So have you seen in your litigation practice situations where, you know, this goes to court and that, you know, they don't like the decision? And what maybe has been the challenge to that problem, that they didn't follow a process, that they didn't make these decisions fairly?
I think that is the problem. I think when the employer doesn't have a good justification for why they chose one employee over the other, it can have a negative effect in litigation, particularly if the impact of it is, for example, always affecting the woman, and that's the person who you're going to transfer or terminate. And when you have that kind of decision and you don't have backup documentation for why you made that specific decision, I think it becomes very difficult to defend in litigation.
Well, because also there's emotion involved, right? And if something goes south after that decision's made, they could say, hey, you forced me out.
Well, that's right. There was a study that was done that showed that about one-third of these situations are consensual relationships that went south. Things were fine, and then one party didn't want to be in the relationship, and that had adverse consequences to the two people involved, but also to the workforce as they became unhappy in their group and in their division, and that spreads negatively to other workers as well.
Well, that certainly is, you know, when we're talking about favoritism, right? So favoritism being an issue where it's a perception of a supervisor or someone being getting better projects, getting better schedules, getting better anything. This plays into harassment in terms of their perception in the workplace.
Exactly. The oftentimes, workplace romance is not permitted because there is a concern about real or perceived favoritism. And that does generate employers or inspire employees, employers to go ahead and develop policies and training on this particular issue. That complaint of favoritism from coworkers of those involved in a workplace romance is a significant issue in the workplace.
Talk to me a little about gossip, because, you know, behind the scenes, there are always people that talk, and I don't care what the issue is. Heck, there could sometimes be no issue, and there's still gossip that's created or happens in a workplace. When you're talking about these type of issues, where do you see this playing out in terms of workplace romance?
You're always going to have gossip in the workplace. That is just going to happen. I've actually seen some employers try to ban gossip in the workplace, which is not generally going to be effective.
So they basically ask people not to talk at all, right? Was that
That's right. And it creates a lot of problems. I mean, it creates the obvious problems, but it also creates the problems that it can be a violation of the National Labor Relations Act. So, you know, you have that issue as well. But it's not an effective way to stop people from talking in the workplace. Now, interestingly, in workplace romance, suspicions about workplace romance are generally revealed through office gossip. I think it's something like 67% of the reports of office romance come in through people gossiping about it and generally HR hearing about it and then needing to take some action. But certainly you're not going to be able to ban, nor should you try or even have a desire to ban gossip in the workplace. That's just human nature.
Talk to me about the morale aspect of this. You know, I do know that certainly anything that creates this perception of gossip, favoritism, harassment, even if it's not even harassment, even if it's consensual, right, creates, you know, a feeling inside an organization that the culture is coming unglued. Talk a little bit about that.
Right. I mean, that's a good point. You're going to experience negativity, morale lowering when employees perceive that one person is being favored over another. And the way it happens in this particular field is that people are involved in a relationship, an office romance, and the perception is that the person who is in favor gets the plum assignments, gets the right to leave early one day. It can be small things, big things, such as pay increases, better transfers, better job opportunities, those type of things can happen when that person is involved in a relationship with someone who has the power to change the terms and conditions of employment for that person. And when that happens, other workers are looking at that and feeling understandably resentful and feeling that it's favoritism, which it certainly can be, and that has a very negative effect on the workplace.
Do you see employers coming to you and simply saying, hey, look, we have these issues, we have these concerns, I'm very concerned about morale and favoritism? I mean, what do you think of the mood of the employer in these situations?
Oh, it's a formidable issue, and it's that continued issue of poor morale, which can decrease productivity, make everyone miserable and unhappy in the workplace. And, you know, that's what happens when employers don't have control of office romance situations. It's that power issue where perhaps a supervisor is involved in a relationship with a subordinate, and the subordinate gets favors because of that. Those are really where I see issues being created and employers being unable to stop the freight train from going downhill. That's really what the issue is.
We're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford, Managing Shareholder, Employment Attorney for Jackson Lewis Law Firm. And we are here at the HR Power Hour, and we will be right back on News Talk WLOB.
They say it's never too late to be what you might have been. So if you want to turn your passion into your profession, AARP can help you find new opportunities that take advantage of Work Reimagined, a program that leverages the power of LinkedIn. AARP also provides access to tools, resources, and information that can help you at every step. Just a few of the ways AARP helps turn your goals and dreams into real possibilities.
AARP, real possibilities.
Go to aarp.org/possibilities to find tools and guidance.
Real Possibilities is a trademark of AARP.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we are talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford, Jackson Lewis employment attorney extraordinaire. Do you like that, Deb? Was that good?
I do. That sounds terrific. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Keep talking.
You're just going to let me talk, right? We're talking about workplace romance, love, sex, and the employer. Just love that topic. Anyways, all right, so, you know, in the first segment here, we talked about the workplace romance itself and some of the traditional issues, I would say, you know, having to do with harassment, having to do with favoritism, gossip, all that good stuff. But, you know, one of the things that I know I'm seeing, I know we've talked about offline, is retaliation. And this retaliation portion having to do with workplace romance, as well as everything else in the country today, is really growing. So tell me what you're seeing. Tell me how employers can think about this. And let's talk about retaliation.
So retaliation claims have increased, I would say, in just about every state and in federal claims as well. And I, at least, have been noticing this trend for at least the past 5 years. And if you looked at statistics for retaliation claims, I think every state agency would tell you that their claims have increased over the five-year period at least. So what happens is that oftentimes employees will bring a claim for some type of a discrimination or harassment based on a protected class, age, race, sex, pregnancy, et cetera. In addition to that, they say that when they make the complaint of harassment or discrimination based on that protected class, they then have adverse action taken against them, which is the retaliation piece. So I complain to you, Dave, as my employer, that I think I've been victimized by sexual harassment, and you say, thank you very much, you're fired, or you're put on the third shift, or you're sent to some undesirable location. And those retaliation claims, those adverse actions based on a good faith report of harassment and or discrimination, are the claims that we are seeing a tremendous increase in the past few years.
So can retaliation also be that somebody puts out information on social media?
It can be. Social media certainly comes into play more and more in the area of employment law, and social media and sexual harassment has increased a great deal in the past several years. So in other words, we're seeing more and more cases of complaints being brought about Facebook or Twitter or MySpace or something like that, when people are, for example, posting online pictures that may be, for example, sexually inappropriate or chats or other postings that have negative comments about, you know, for example, sexual activities or a protected category.
So we're going to talk more about social media in a little bit, but and to get back to retaliation a little bit. Where could you give an example of maybe a recent case certainly can protect the guilty and the innocent. How that? In terms of the information you provide in your example of what you're seeing so that people or employers can really understand like what's really happening from a real life perspective.
Sure. So the example would be, let's take a typical sexual harassment complaint. So let's just say it's a female employee who complains that a male supervisor is sexually harassing her by sending her inappropriate cartoons or emails, making inappropriate sexual comments to her, repeatedly asking her out on dates, even though she keeps telling him that she doesn't want to have a relationship. She makes that complaint, that report, to, let's say, HR or to the supervisor's boss and says, I think I am a victim of sexual harassment, and I'd like you to do something about it. And as a result of that, she gets put on the third shift, or she gets a demotion, or she doesn't get the promotion that she feels she's entitled to, or the pay increase, or she gets fired. And the employer says, well, it really happened for performance issues, but the allegation is, and the lawsuit is based on, my performance is fine, and my performance review says that I meet expectations, so it really must be because I made a good faith report of sexual harassment by my boss, and as a result of that, you're taking adverse action against me.
Timing is everything in life, and sometimes employers are, you know, stuck between a rock and a hard place. They are ready to do some sort of performance issue with somebody, and lo and behold, they bring forward some sort of claim. How should employers tread in these type of waters?
Well, employers have to be very careful, and there are lots of things that employers can do, but unfortunately often do not, to protect an employer's adverse action. I mean, for example, as you know, and in your field, documentation is a critical component of taking any kind of adverse action against an employee, and whether that's a demotion or a pay decrease or a termination. Without the documentation, it becomes very difficult to defend when you have a timing issue, such that I reported, for example, sexual harassment 2 weeks before I got the demotion or you fired me. Unless you have very good documentation, it's hard to defend that action because a jury or a fact finder is likely to believe that it's in direct correlation to the complaint of the harassment and or the discrimination than it is to the performance issue. So employers really need to make sure that they train supervisors and managers on how to do effective, proper, honest, direct evaluations and give warnings when it is appropriate.
Yeah, I think performance management is always a challenge. And I think that that really goes down to the supervisory level and the fact that they have to really make sure they understand how to do it properly and that documentation is in place. You're right. You're spot on with what you're talking about, obviously. But I see employers struggle with this. Why do you think it's so difficult for them to get management to do that?
I think in part it's thankless work. It takes a lot of time and effort to do a proper evaluation. I mean, you can't sit down and do a good evaluation in 5-10 minutes. And you can't do it while you're watching something on TV. It requires a lot of time. And what I hear from supervisors and managers when I do trainings is that the forms are too complicated. It takes me too much time. I'm so busy doing my job duties, and I barely have time to do that, let alone do 10, 12, whatever it is, the number of evaluations. So I think part of it is a time crunch issue, and part of it is that it's just not work that the managers generally like to do. Some of it also is that I think many of us have trouble being direct. And it's always interesting to me that managers will often say that they don't want to speak negatively about an employee on an evaluation, because they want to be nice and they want to do the great inflation, or they want to give the employee an opportunity. But when something happens and then they say they want to terminate that employee, but the performance evaluations meets expectations and or they've given a pay increase, it's difficult to justify a termination unless you have the proper documentation.
When do you see most of the time retaliation happening, having to do with workplace romance?
Well, I see it more when employees complain about favoritism issues, and when the coworker complains that another worker is being favored because he or she is involved in a relationship with the manager, and then that co-employee gets disciplined or terminated as a result of the complaint. And I have a couple of cases going on right now with that fact pattern. Now, what the employer says is that it had nothing to do with the complaint of favoritism of the other employee and more to do with performance issues. But again, if the evaluations and the personnel file don't reflect a continuing pattern of issues with the employee, it's tough to take adverse action.
No, it absolutely is. We're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford from Jackson Lewis Law Firm. Deborah, one of the things that you have brought forward and you said you would talk about today is the policies which could be implemented to help employers really look at this and make smart decisions in their pre-work, right? All their work that they need to set in place prior to having these issues happen. What are some of the policies that you think they need to look at, some of the things they can put in place?
So there are a couple of different policies. You can call them different things. I have a client who calls them consensual relationship policies. I have another that calls it office romance policy. But basically, they are policies which establish what is an inappropriate office relationship. So they generally start out by strongly discouraging relationships between, for example, supervisors, managers, and an employee. And it discourages that type of romantic relationship, and then it talks about that if a relationship should develop despite the policy, there's a mandatory obligation of the supervisor and or manager to promptly disclose the existence of the relationship to the human resource manager.
So when they're reporting, is there a formal process they report in? Do you recommend that it gets that serious where they send an email, they fill out some sort of form, or that it's documented in some specific way so it's consistent, or is it okay if it's just, verbal?
I think it should be written. I think there has to be some type of a mechanism and some type of documentation to show that the supervisor and or manager reported the existence of the relationship to HR. Now, that is generally done in the policies that I see and that I'm drafting in writing. It could be verbal, but even a verbal report needs to be documented. We talk about this with oral warnings, for example, that even though it's a verbal or oral warning, we're still going ahead and documenting it so that later we can look back and see that the process did occur.
Yeah, I know. I always find it funny when we're saying, if we're going to give you a verbal, but it's going to be a written. And sometimes people don't understand that it's really more a documentation, right, of what
was said
during it. Because, heck, I don't remember what I did yesterday, let alone what happened, 2-3 months ago in terms of it.
Exactly. And in this day and age, with people leaving the workforce, and we don't expect people anymore to work at one place for an entire career, we want to have some kind of a historical marker so that we can go back and look to see what happened in the past. Otherwise, it gets very difficult to do that.
So let's talk about what should be some of the disciplinary policies. Should, a romance take place? Should something inappropriate happen at the workplace in terms of, even if it's between consensual adults, what are some of the things we need to look at in terms of from a disciplinary standpoint? Should it be the standard three strikes, you're out, or should there be some sort of level of understanding when these things happen?
Well, I'll give you a lawyer answer. It really depends.
Shocking.
Yes, shocking. I think first the employer has to make a risk assessment of what the danger or damage could be to the workforce. So that, for example, if we're talking about a direct report, that's a situation where I really think the employer can't find any great solution if the two are involved in a consensual relationship. Somebody's got to be transferred or terminated, depending on the circumstances. And then there are different lines that are beneath that. when you have a worker and a supervisor, but not a direct supervisor. So you really have to make that risk assessment of how it's going to impact the workplace. Once you do that, then I think there are a variety of options. I mean, you can look at transferring one or both of the parties to the relationship, terminating one or both parties to the relationship, adjusting the lines of reporting or communication. And then you can require parties to acknowledge in writing that the relationship is consensual, it's voluntary, and the parties acknowledge that and are letting the employer know that it's a consensual relationship. Those are the more typical options. There is something called love contracts, which we can talk about as well. Those are another way to deal with it, although, in my opinion, not a terribly effective way.
Okay. Yeah, we'll certainly talk about that in the next segment. Talk to me a little bit about, does it matter, and I suspect the answer is no, but whether it is a regular traditional relationship or a gay and lesbian relationship or anything like that, does the policy have to be modified, or some of the policies that were written previously need to be modified to reflect today's lifestyles?
It doesn't make a difference legally, and in this day and age, the policy should cover a female-male relationship, a same-sex relationship. They should be looked at equally. So if a policy was written a long time ago and talks about male-female, then it should be rewritten. But most policies these days talk about consenting romantic relationships, particularly between a supervisor and an employee. And but I do think that employers should check their policies to make sure they're up to date.
Well, that's a tip really for everyone, right? Some manuals may be outdated, and they may refer to anything incorrectly today in their handbook. So that is something that should be looked at as a general rule anyway, correct?
That's absolutely right. And also, what we're finding is that a lot of employers do not have policies that address workplace romance. I think it was something like 55% of employers do not have a workplace romance policy.
And that's probably because it wasn't even thought about when the policy was put together, when the organization was founded or generally upkeep. It's just not something that gets spoken a lot about.
I think that's right. The same with training. I mean, this is not generally an area that managers were trained about. That is a very high percentage of employers would tell you that when they do, for example, anti-harassment training, they do not cover workplace romances. I think that's changing somewhat, but not a lot. That still is generally the case.
Well, it's a miss if they aren't, because obviously today you kind of have to cover all the basics in this particular case. We're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford. She's an employment attorney with Jackson Lewis Law Firm. We're talking about workplace romance on the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
You might hear some advice from your friends on choosing a health plan.
Darling, you must choose the gold healthcare plan.
Not the silver plan. Too much trouble. Do they have a stainless steel plan?
I like bronze, like my tan.
Are sunburns covered? Instead, take advice from a licensed agent from Northern Insurance Group. Meet face-to-face with a local healthcare exchange professional. Call Northern Insurance Group today. We have the resources to make sure you make the right choice.
And we're back on the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford of Jackson Lewis Law Firm about workplace romance.
exciting and
that's right, the Love Boat, ladies and gentlemen. That could be your workplace. Deborah, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, and I cannot top the Love Boat, I'm sure.
Well, I'm sure you've had some situations where you're dealing with the Love Boat, I'm sure. I'm absolutely positive.
No question.
All right, you know, we were talking in the last segment about policies that employers need to put in place. And one of the things you talked about was a love contract. Now, I'm going to be the first one to tell you, I've never heard of a love contract. So I am curious what this is about and why employers would even consider using them.
Yeah, the first time I had a client ask me to write up a love contract, I thought, what? Wait. So a love contract indicates that the relationship between the two parties is consensual, that the couple won't engage in any favoritism, and that neither will take legal action against the employer or each other if the relationship ends. Now, only about 5% of employers ask those in a romantic, consensual relationship to sign what's known as a love contract. And most HR professionals, in fact, the last study I saw from SHRM said that 75% consider the contract to be ineffective and believe that it actually encourages workers to hide the relationship from peers because, you know, they don't want to tell anybody about it. But I do occasionally, at least once a year, I will have a client that asks me to write a love contract. And so I do.
It's kind of like a prenup.
It is kind of like a prenup, and you know, you really have to question the validity of it. But I think the point is really to get the employees to consider the consequences of a relationship that goes south. I think it's more to heighten awareness and more as an education piece than it is really for the contractual implications of it.
Do you think this is, now, just to follow up on this a little bit more, is this when two people are still going to be in their same roles, or is it even if they're going to be separated into two different departments or divisions?
Both, actually. So even if they're going to be separated, and some of these contracts can be rather lengthy. In other words, generally state, the general provisions are that they're advised that the company has a policy, and many employers who do this will attach a copy of their policy to the agreement. So you're getting the employee to acknowledge that the company has a policy about consensual relationships and to acknowledge that they'll abide by the policy. It goes on to generally represent that the relationship is consensual and that the individuals have not violated the company's policies prohibiting sexual harassment. Again, acknowledging that the company has a policy, acknowledging that these two employees know that they take responsibility, that they're not violating the policy.
Does it have clauses if something goes wrong?
It does have clauses if something goes wrong. They will inform HR, for example, in writing that the relationship has terminated. They will agree that they will not violate any of the company's policies on courtesy and getting along with others in the workplace and not taking retaliatory actions. Some of them, Dave, are actually even more interesting because they talk about keeping a professional demeanor at work while the couple is involved. In other words, not hugging or kissing or holding hands or touching each other in a sexually suggestive manner in the workplace. I've seen at least half the policies I write on this. My clients want me to put in something like that because it makes other employees uncomfortable and goes to this favoritism issue as well.
Well, that is a first because I have not necessarily.
That
is a very interesting idea. I mean, I could certainly see some validity to the thought process. I do. I do see some validity because it does spell out, and it does, I suspect, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, protect the employer a little bit from saying, hey, look, they agreed to all this. And if you don't do all this, then we have the right to terminate, have the right to discipline, have the right to, you know, maybe have both parties leave. I could see some value to it, but that does seem to be pretty intrusive.
Yeah, and I think that's why most employers don't use them. And then there's a question of whether it really is effective. But, you know, these love contracts will often have a clause similar to, I acknowledge that violation of this agreement or of the policy may result in immediate termination of my employment. In other words, a notice provision in there, which some employers feel is effective in that it lets people know that, look, we can't stop you from having a relationship. That is human nature. We don't want to get into that business. But if it does interfere or, in some way contradict our policies, then you could be looking at adverse employment action, including termination. So it's an interesting idea.
So based upon your history of using this, do you think these are things you would recommend to an organization, or is it still something that is really maybe one-on-one based?
I think it really depends on the circumstances, again, to give a lawyer answer. I mean, I rarely will recommend it, only because I do agree with the Sherm study that it generally is ineffective, because I think that what happens is that most employees will tend to hide a relationship when they know they have a policy like this, so it does become rather onerous. Also, for most of the HR people that I talk to, they hate these policies. They don't want to enforce it. They don't really want to get involved in this, so it just becomes a difficult proposition for HR.
Well, that really is the other problem, right? Because these are so personal in nature that HR, as well as most employers, most managers, most executives, the minute you start going down this path, everybody gets a little bit like, oh God, I don't want to talk about this. This is not something I really am comfortable with. But they do have to be more comfortable with, and I think that's where, as you said, the training, the development, the understanding that these things are real, that they happen, and maybe it's not like the ostrich putting your head in the sand. You do need to deal with them.
Yeah, you do, and I think the whole nature of HR has changed. I mean, anybody who's a HR professional will tell you that, and I'm sure that you would say the same as well. I mean, it used to be that we would get people in HR who just had good people skills, and it's not like that anymore. That's always helpful for anything that you do in life, but in today's world, it is a very difficult job and requires dealing with many uncomfortable situations, and dealing with it efficiently and effectively and expeditiously. It just is something that you cannot put these things off because, as you know, they just get worse.
No, that's life, right? In general, if you're going to put something off because you're not really comfortable with it and it's an issue, it's probably not going away. It's probably going to become a bigger issue. You know, putting your head
doesn't get any better the next day.
That's
I try
exactly
to live by
correct.
That.
It's the truth.
Absolutely.
It's absolutely
true. Wish it
true.
Did, but it doesn't.
No, it's true. So we talked a little bit in the last segment about social media and some of the issues that have come up with social media. What are some of the things, you know, despite the fact that we talked a little bit about it in terms of retaliation, what are some of the social media issues that you are seeing in the workplace romance area?
So this is a tremendous issue in the workplace these days. And just to give you an example of some of the social media cases, I just pulled up a few, and here are just some highlights. Some of the cases involved employees, for example, setting up a Facebook group page to humiliate a coworker for sexual indiscretions. That's a case that's going on now. Or posting a photo on Facebook of an employee bending over at work showing her underwear. That's a case that's going on right now. Or posting seductive pictures of an employee on MySpace. That's a case that's going on now. Or sending repeated unsolicited Facebook chats. That's a case that's going on now. And so the issue becomes that often these things are done out of work, so-called off-duty conduct, but that can still be a hostile work environment claim at the workplace. And the social media activity off-duty or can even be done while people are working in today's world becomes an increased risk for employers.
When you're talking about this group, was it a private group? Just so make sure people understand, or could anybody see this group information on Facebook?
It depended. Sometimes on this particular case where was a private chat, although there were friends on this chat who were employees. So some of the employees that were being made fun of were friends of people posting, although the chats weren't friendly, if you will.
I got it. Well, they were basically griping, right, about the employee and complaining. Is that not protected under the NLRB, new protection having to do with social media?
It is protected activity. There are, you know, as you know, many, many cases now that have been issued by the NLRB, basically enforcing the National Labor Relations Act. And the board and its general counsel and some administrative judges have interpreted the NLRA broadly so as to include people griping about the terms and conditions of employment. And that is what is known as protected activity, and the employer cannot prohibit that type of activity. It needs to be concerted, meaning that one employee chats with another employee or a group discussion, as opposed to individualized griping, which would not be protected under the Act.
So if somebody outs somebody on Facebook that they're having a relationship, my term, best one I could come up with. Somebody
That's a
outs,
good term.
It's a great term. Somebody outs somebody having this relationship, and another employee chipes in that they have heard or seen about it too. Is that protected at that point?
It's protected if they're talking about the terms and conditions of employment. But this Facebook mechanism is a way that employers will learn oftentimes about a relationship. So HR, for example, will have no idea that two people are involved in a romantic relationship, and then somebody will post something on Facebook, somebody joins in that discussion, and then employee comes to HR and says, hey, by the way, I was looking at my Facebook last night, and did you know that John and Jane are involved in a relationship? And that's oftentimes how employers find out about workplace romance.
It's a brave new world of social media. We're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford, Jackson Lewis Law Firm. She's an employment attorney there, and we're talking about workplace romance. You're listening to the HR Power Hour and News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we have been speaking with Deborah Weiss-Ford, employment attorney with Jackson Lewis Law Firm. And we've been talking about workplace romance. Deborah, as we wind down the show today, first of all, it's been great having you on the show. And I know that anybody that wants to get a hold of you, they can go to FordD@JacksonLewis.com. Correct? That's your email.
That's correct.
Or they can call you directly at 603-559-2727 there in the good old Portsmouth, New Hampshire area, correct?
That's correct.
Awesome. Well, you have some tips that you wanted to share at the end of the show here for employers dealing with or protecting themselves from workplace romance issues. So go right ahead. Lay them out.
Sure. So first of all, I think it's important that employers train the workforce. Training both supervisors and workers can go a long way towards stamping out behavior that may be inappropriate in the workplace. And as always with training, I think it's good to ensure that employees know what is expected of them and where to go if problems arise. So in this particular field, you want to have a good sexual harassment policy that has a good definition of what is sexual harassment, has a zero tolerance policy, and gives a good reporting procedure so that employees know where to go, and of course bans retaliation. In conjunction with that, what's important, I think, in this line of work is that employers train their managers and supervisors on workplace romances and to talk about what is acceptable behavior and what is not and what are the consequences to it, and then to have a reporting procedure so that employers can stay on top of it. That's the first tip that I would give. The second tip is to have a policy that deals with workplace romance and what the employer is going to allow and what it's not going to allow. The policy can be a part of your anti-harassment policies, or it could be a separate workplace romance policy that I think would be helpful to the employer, again, so that employees have notice of what's acceptable and what's not, and what to do if situations occur that need to be dealt with by the employer. So those are the two most important tips that I would give to employers. The other two tips I would say is that I don't think it's really effective to ban dating. Every once in a while, an employer will ask me to write a policy banning dating, and I think an outright ban on intimate intra-office relationship usually isn't very effective. People are spending more and more time at work, relationships are going to occur, and that generally is just not effective. Similarly, and as we talked about, my last point would be to consider a love contract, but think about really whether it's going to be effective for you as the employer, or whether it's going to deter employees from being open and honest about a relationship. So I think that there are some merits to a love contract, but it really is only for a particular individualized situation, not generally going to give a benefit for the most part in workplace romances.
Deborah, those are great tips, and it takes us right to the end of the show today. I want to thank you so much for being on the show and providing this information having to do with, obviously, workplace romance. And it is a serious issue. I know we had some fun talking about it today, and hopefully the audience enjoyed the fun that we've had. But it is serious, and these are great tips that individual owners and HR professionals need to be looking at each and every day at their workplace. So again, Deb, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. Greatly appreciate it.
And now the HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group. Licensed agents in 28 states, business, commercial, and personal. Go to northerninsurancegroup.com. You've mastered the interview, and now it's time to send a personalized thank you. Quit digging around your old junk drawer for a crinkled stamp or an old school stationery in favor of a new app called Felt, F-E-L-T. For $3.99 per card, the app does the mailing for you, while still conveying the thoughtfulness of a handwritten note. And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group at northerninsurancegroup.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, our guest will be Joe Frodsham. He is the author of the new book, Make It Work, Navigate Your Career Without Leaving Your Organization. We're going to be talking about career myths and the truth. We're going to be talking about engagement, and we're going to be talking about the power of assessment to get the right people in your organization. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.